U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
New testimony in the impeachment investigation of Donald Trump has the press saying that they have that the Democrats have found a smoking gun to prove a quid pro quo between Donald Trump and the Ukrainian president, Zelensky, trading an investigation into Joe Biden and corruption in Ukraine for U.S. aid. Is that true? We'll talk about the latest details. Plus, some Democrats are worrying publicly that their current presidential field may not have what it takes to defeat Donald Trump in 2020. Could someone else jump into the presidential race? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with The Wall Street Journal and here with my colleagues, Kim Strassel. Hello, Kim.
Hello, Paul.
Taking a break from selling her new book, Resistance at All Costs, as well as, you appreciate that plug, Kim, plus Kyle Peterson.
Thank
you. Kyle.
Hello, hello.
All right, let's talk about the testimony, which is being varied by William Taylor, former Trump envoy to Ukraine, never formally approved by the Senate, confirmed by the Senate as ambassador, but nonetheless an envoy that Mike Pompeo handpicked earlier this year to work with him on Ukraine, told the Senate Intelligence Committee this week that in a lengthy statement, a long chronology of events in his after he took the job dealing with Ukraine, where he describes essentially a two-tier process, a two-track process of U.S. policy towards Ukraine. One, the official policy of saying we support Ukraine and we're going to continue to provide aid and working with the new government of President Zelensky to try to improve relations. And another one, the track that has been described as sort of the Donald Trump Rudy Giuliani track, which attempted to lobby, according to Taylor, the Ukrainians to investigate Joe Biden and, in as Taylor says, raise even mention in public that he will investigate corruption and Joe and Hunter Biden's activities in Ukraine in return for a visit to the United States by Ambassador Zelensky, to a visit to the White House, and aid. The continuation of USAID. Kim, what do you make of this?
Well, a lot of the press is out there reporting that this is what he testified to, that he said that, you know, I know it to be the case that the White House was demanding that Ukrainians investigate Burisma and Joe Biden as a condition of getting aid. When you actually read his testimony, we get a lot more of what we've had up until now. We already knew that this was Mr. Taylor's suspicion. We had a set of text messages that were given to Congress in which he confronts the EU ambassador, Gordon Sondland, and says, I think this is a terrible thing to be withholding aid for a political benefit. And Sondland replies, that's not what's happening. There is no quid pro quo. I think you misunderstand this. So now we get this opening statement. And I think the key line is he says, this is what happened. This is why I believed this to be true. And then, but I think the point of that is that as you go through, he basically essentially repeats his suspicions about this, but there seems to be disagreement continuing over whether or not that was indeed the White House's intent or that was simply what he believed it to be.
There's no question we now have continuing this this pattern, Kyle, in this investigation in which somebody testifies in secret Part of the, and that's what the impeachment hearings now are. They are in secret. And then based on what is said, somebody leaks the essence or supposed essence of what he said. And sometimes the opening statement, as in the case of Mr. Taylor, is leaked. But then you get the alternative view, which is comes out, the Republicans come out and say, look, this isn't the complete story. You have, in this case, Lee Zeldin, Republican, who was in the meetings, who said she spent almost an entire day in Schiff's super secret bunker. That's Adam Schiff, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, in the Capitol basement for Ambassador Taylor's deposition. This transcript should be released ASAP, along with all of the other transcripts. Much of this leaked opening statement collapsed, but Schiff keeps the public in the dark on that.
Well, that's one of the questions, is what do these other witnesses say? So, you know, the White House press secretary attacked the Taylor opening statement as third hand, and there's nothing to that. I mean, certainly I think this is closer to an allegation of a quid pro quo, at least on the aid, than we've seen so far. But, you know, just to read a portion of the opening statement.
From the ambassador.
You know, Mr. Morrison told him that Ambassador Sondland told Mr. Yermak that the security assistance money would not come until President Zelensky committed to pursue a Burisma investigation. So, I mean, that is third hand. One of the dangers that it opens up here is that to the extent that this contradicts any of the testimony that was, has already been given by Ambassador Gordon Sondland, that's a problem. But
potentially
we don't,
for Sondland.
Well, potentially for Sondland, potentially for the White House, but we don't know what that testimony is because it hasn't been made public.
Yeah,
so far.
That also hasn't been made public. Just as a recitation of facts, Kim, I read the Taylor testimony is hardly flattering to this administration's conduct of Ukraine policy. At a minimum, it looks like there was an awful lot of backdoor maneuvering going on, even by government standards. Rudy Giuliani doing his thing, Mike Pompeo doing his with various envoys, different envoys not knowing what the other was really doing, and if there was and some having access to Trump, some others not having access to Trump. And then John Bolton, the former national security advisor, looks in this testimony to be something of a hero if you wanted to continue with U.S.-Ukraine policy, because he that is the U.S. supporting Ukraine with military assistance, because he didn't want the interference of the corruption investigation interfere with that U.S. strategic policy.
Yeah. So here's how I read this testimony, and I've read it several times now, is that the Rudy involvement once again looks very bad. I mean, what on earth was he doing there? And it's very clear that his very presence set off alarm bells at the State Department, and that this is in no small part why we're even having this discussion. I think the other thing it exposes is a lot of this does not necessarily surprise me, given the constant upheaval in the White House and people changing jobs, a lot of confusion about who was running things and where messages were being sent. This was not an orderly process by which messages were being delivered to the Ukrainians and messages were coming back to the United States. So that was very messy. But what I also read in this, which I think is notable, is that there does seem to be, and I think we have to address this question. Bill Taylor, longtime State Department official, there seems to be a bit of grumpiness emanating from this testimony about the fact that State Department wasn't just being left to itself to call all of its shots. So there seems to be some institutional arguments going on there. He goes to Great Lake to try to explain what he called an irregular channel that was being operated outside of the State Department. But if you look at the people who were involved in that supposedly irregular channel, they include the Secretary of State, the Special Envoy, Colt Kurt Volker, the ambassador to the EU. I'm not entirely sure why those folks wouldn't have had a legitimate role in talking about all of this. So it kind of reads a little bit like a guy who, you know, the State Department, a lot of officials have had a lot of hostility to Donald Trump since he came in and his foreign policy. And all of that just has to be looked at and included in this discussion as well.
All right. We're talking about the latest impeachment testimony for the Senate Intelligence Committee and Democratic presidential candidates. Could another person get in? And you're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kim Strassel and Kyle Peterson. And I want to take up, Kim, with you where you left off, which is you're talking about the State Department and a certain hostility here. But I want to push back a little bit on that because I think that's certainly all real. But a lot of this pushback was also coming from the White House, if Taylor's testimony is to be believed. And that, I mean, the National Security Council staff with John Bolton and his deputy for Ukraine, Fiona Hill, because both of them did not like this this irregular channel, which seemed to have emanated from the president and various people inside the security team. Some of them worked at the State Department. But at one point in the testimony, he says, Taylor says, this is an opening statement, says that John Bolton had even said to somebody that he opposed the phone call that ultimately took place on July 25th between Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine because he said it would be a disaster. Now, was that ever prescient?
Well, right. I mean, and by the way, I should have addressed your Bolton question. Yes, he does come off as a bit of a hero. And does this surprise us? John Bolton gives sound advice. And we've all been worried since he left about where all that went. But he clearly, even when he was there, some of his good advice was not being heeded. But I think, too, if you look at this, and this is just important, what seemed to be really going on here, if you step back, a big debate over whether or not Ukrainian aid, military aid for the Ukraine should be withheld under any circumstances. And some who believing that there was a legitimate reason to ask them to deal with corruption and investigations, and some saying, no, that is not a good enough reason ever to not provide this aid to Ukraine. That seems to be the big debate that was happening.
Well, that was the debate. And then also Trump wanting to slide into this corruption debate, the Joe Biden, Kyle.
Right. And, you know, you can read this testimony, too, and read it as, you know, Ambassador Sondland, the ambassador of the EU, also trying to placate the president. There's one point where he, according to Taylor, talks about giving specific language to the Ukrainian president. You know, maybe you should tell President Trump that you're not going to leave any stone unturned. And so you can also read it as, you know, Sondland, some of these other guys were pushing in the same direction as Taylor. They wanted to get the aid and they were trying to figure out how to get Trump to give the okay, which, you know, may not be as bad a position as they are looking right now from some of the other testimony.
All of which suggests to me, just to make a final point on this, because we'll know more as this as the weeks unfold here, but all of which brings home to me this Taylor testimony and the reporting on it. The fundamental disservice that the Democrats in the House are doing to the country as they pursue this impeachment hearing in secret. I mean, they really, really, really are doing a disservice because they're allowing, you know, partial information to leak out. They're not disclosing the transcripts. They're not telling us what the full context of the remarks are, what the follow-up questions are, how somebody responded to questions, what about the different seeming contradictions here. And it, you know, the average citizen and even indeed the average fair-minded journalist who isn't already a propagandist for impeachment is going to look back and say, I don't know what the truth is because I don't know what the evidence is.
No, that's absolutely right. Look, the Republicans that have come out of these hearings have just been utterly unswayed. You know, if there was something, I mean, they're what they basically said is, yes, some of these opening statements have bits and pieces that sound very damning. But you go in and under questioning, there is no evidence there, you know, and it collapses. And you know, we deserve to know if that's true or not. You know, who's telling it straight in all of this? But this is just a terrible way to go about it. And you're right, Paul. It's a great disservice given what an enormous power impeachment is.
No, I agree. And it's continuing every day. So today, the Laura Cooper, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the area, including Ukraine, is testifying. You know, we're going to get more witnesses called every day. And I, for one, would like to know what they're saying.
I would indeed. All right. It certainly would help with fair-minded journalism. All right. Let's turn here to kind of interesting and in some ways amusing story of the week, which is some Democrats going on the record with concerns about whether or not their current presidential field, anyone in that current presidential field, can defeat Donald Trump in 2020. And it's manifesting itself in some journalism stories, and one in the Washington Post quoting Elaine Kmark, who is a veteran of the Clinton administration and seasoned Democratic activist John Cole, who's a trial lawyer who is also linked to the Clintons. And they're wondering aloud, can any of these folks actually beat Trump? And their concerns, Kim, start with the fact that Joe Biden has been underwhelming and is now having money problems, raising enough money. Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders perceived probably to be too far left on Medicare for All. And some of the others simply not being of enough stature to beat Trump. Now, I've been around a long time, and I've seen these stories crop up in every cycle where people say, we can't possibly win. Look at this field. Somebody else has got to get in. And I think that a lot of Republicans were there in 2016, and lo and behold, Donald Trump managed to win. What do you think? Is this a legitimate concern, or is this grousing from some in the Clinton wing who are agitating to get her in the race?
I think it's both. Look, yes, this is just a staple of every Democratic primary, right? I mean, they go along and suddenly they get near the opening of the Iowa caucuses and everyone says, oh my gosh, we can't possibly do it with this field. Who can we bring in? And then they tend to get over it. But I do think that there's some folks out there that nonetheless do have some real concerns. And there are, just if you look at the ground right now, you mentioned Joe Biden and his finance troubles. Those are real problems. The guy right now has $9 million on hand, and he's still in the middle of a multi-state primary. People are wondering if he possibly has the dollars to get through that. You see Warren surging, or at least continuing to creep up in the polls, but there are massive concerns within the party about her viability as an actual candidate and whether she is electable. People have been talking about Pete Buttigieg a lot lately, but you look at his support and he does not seem to be able to break out beyond white voters. And that's obviously a problem for the Democratic Party. So what happens now? I think that all of this could potentially change. Maybe they could actually get somebody who jumped in, say, if Joe Biden dropped out. But at the moment, this just seems to be a lot of hand-wringing.
And I would note that it's also a problem on the Republican side at times. I mean, remember the polling in 2012, when Mitt Romney was the front runner, and then maybe, you know, five or six other candidates had their moment in the sun. I think this is just the paralysis of choice. You have, it's like 400 channels and nothing on TV. You got 20 candidates. All of them have a downside. And look at the names that are floating around as possible entrants. You know, Hillary Clinton, there's some negatives there. Mike Bloomberg, there's some negatives. John Kerry, he didn't win last time.
Michelle Obama. Is she the savior?
The polling there is pretty good. She's a very popular figure, but she's the kind of figure that you're popular because you don't have to take any unpleasant stances. And I think that would deflate pretty quickly if she were on the debate stage. stage answering Medicare for All questions.
The old cliche about these candidates who are off in the wings is that they their best and strongest polling data will be on the day they announce, and then they go downhill after they're fighting one another. But look, I would say I think Hillary Clinton, in no doubt, hankers a desire to beat Donald Trump after the humiliation of losing to that man, quote unquote, as they like to say. But I don't see how, with her baggage of having already lost, if your concern is whether you can beat Donald Trump, you're going to renominate somebody who already lost to Donald Trump. That doesn't strike me as the strongest way to go. Bloomberg, however, I think is a different and more interesting potential candidate because he could come in and spend $1 billion like pocket change and throw it into the race. And if he got in early enough here, probably within the next month to meet the different filing deadlines for primaries and caucuses, he could shake things up.
Yeah, except for the problem for Bloomberg. Remember, why did he decide not to run in the first place? It was because he had done an analysis and come to the conclusion that his particular brand of politics was simply not left enough to activate that progressive base, and that he didn't have a path for winning. Now, does that change if he were to survive the primary, win the primary, and then he is their nominee? I'm not sure.
Well, hold on. Just one thing, Kim. But if it looks like it's going to be Elizabeth Warren's nomination, if nobody in Biden fades, nobody else has popped up, and you're left with the choice of Elizabeth Warren or Donald Trump, Bloomberg might say, well, then a lot of the people who might have doubts about my positions on taxes or crime in the Democratic primary, they'd say, hey, you're our savior against a weak nominee.
Well, possible, except for, again, the masses of progressives out there. I agree with you, but this goes back to the fact that there is this split at the moment in the Democratic Party. I agree with you. The pragmatists in the party, the guys that are only concerned about beating Donald Trump, they would probably see that as a very inviting prospect. But, you know, the demand justice folks, the progressive base, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez communities out there,
she'd have
a
heart
attack. Are they really going to vote?
Yeah,
are they going to vote for a Mike Bloomberg in a national election, or will they just stay home?
Right. I mean, their line is that every billionaire is a policy failure. And by that measure, Mike Bloomberg is a policy failure several times over. Although I
like
will
about
say,
40 or 50.
He could at least make a go of it in the way that somebody without those kind of resources could. I mean, we constantly hear comparisons to previous elections. You know, in 1992, Bill Clinton was only at polling at 3% or something. I mean, you hear comparisons like that all the time. But the fact is that the cycle has moved up. We're still a long way from Iowa, but, you know, donors are writing checks already. People have hired staff already. And if you're going to come in, jump in late, you have to be able to compete with that.
Well, and you have to have the money. And that's where Bloomberg would have something as of an advantage over any of the other potential late entrants. The one thing I would say, though, just going back to our original point here, is that at this stage in the cycle, all the candidates are beating each other up. There's always this level of angst. My view continues to be that given where Donald Trump is in the polls and given the fact that he's never really managed to get much above 45% in terms of his approval, despite a strong economy, that any Democratic candidate, virtually anyone, can beat Donald Trump. And I include Elizabeth Warren as somebody who could beat Donald Trump. Kim?
Well, I think she could. And we just don't have a sense yet. Look, I keep reminding people that this primary in some ways has been overshadowed so much by the impeachment drama and everything else that's been coming out that and the number of candidates that is on the stage that we don't really have a sense of what it's going to look like in a head-to-head matchup. Doesn't Elizabeth Warren, when you finally see her policies out on display, can she sell them or is it truly just so radical that Americans can't support her? So much of this is going to come down to who their nominee actually is. Choices matter. And so much of this is speculation right now.
That's true. One thing about Elizabeth Warren that's interesting, though, is she is playing a similar sort of populist message about the swamp, for lack of a better term, as Donald Trump. I mean, the Trump victory in 2016 was notable in that he flipped states that Republicans needed to win and that they hadn't won in a while. Elizabeth Warren will play similarly in those states, I think, when she talks about, you know, corruption in Washington is why we can't get anything done. It's almost the flip side of the Trump message.
All right. It will be fun to watch in any case. Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Kim. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later in the week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.